This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Have you ever Googled yourself? If you haven't, someone else probably has. Maybe they're thinking about hiring you or dating you. And the internet never forgets. A mistake from a decade ago might be the first thing someone sees.
I'm Rachel, calling from Chicago. About 10 years ago, my husband was accused of a felony that he didn't commit. He was acquitted and his record was expunged, but there are still pretty misleading, sensationalized news articles available online. We've tried to get these articles taken down, but most places have refused. And we're concerned that this information being available online might jeopardize or might already have jeopardized chances at employment and stuff like that.
Rachel's problem is something the European Union is addressing legally. It draws on a legal principle known as the right to be forgotten. Today in Europe, people can petition Google to remove links to documents about them from its search engine. That option does not exist in the U.S., but some have taken this matter into their own hands. We'll explore this right to be forgotten, see how far it reaches, and consider whether it should exist in America too. Now, if you've had experience with this, we would love to hear from you. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us from WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland is Chris Quinn, the editor of the news site Cleveland.com. It's experimenting with its own right to be forgotten policy. Chris, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
How did this policy come about?
Well, it came about because of calls just like Rachel's. We would hear from people regularly saying that stories on your site about mistakes I made are wrecking my life. And traditionally, newspapers considered themselves the first version of history and would never even consider taking something down. But as these requests increased in frequency, we finally said we can't stand on tradition. We're a fulcrum for people suffering. We have to try to do something. And it was around the same time as the European right was making news.
Was there one particular last straw that moved Cleveland.com to set a formal policy?
No. There was a case that started our conversation that really bothered me. It was a kid that when he was graduating from high school, he and his friends were drinking and they broke some sort of military monument. It was big news because it was a military monument and he ended up paying his penalty. He went and spoke at veterans' homes. So here it was 5-6 years later. He's graduated college. He's entering the professional field, and this is the first thing that shows up. We're a huge site, the biggest in Ohio. If we've written about you and somebody searches your name, we're going to be there. And I didn't feel good. I felt, why do we keep this story up when there's almost no value to it today, when it is destroying this kid's future? And it was just a mistake. The question I kept asking my staff is, how long does somebody have to pay for a mistake because of what we do?
How did the staff react to this idea?
Well, originally, it was interesting. It was heated. About half the staff was dead set against it. About half saw it as something we should do. But there was so much animosity that I realized we weren't ready yet. So we kept talking about it for a few more years. And as we did, I got the sense the industry's opposition to this was softening somewhat. Finally, last year, I just became fed up. I felt like I can no longer stand on this tradition. We are wrecking people's lives for no real good reason. So we set up a system, pretty rudimentary, and we're not holding it out as the answer. We don't say this is the answer. We hope the industry evolves best practices, but we're taking things out. We're taking names down. We're taking some stories off the site so they're not visible to help people out. And I'm telling you, they are so grateful to get the second chance.
Let's talk about that process. Say that there's a story about me. I'm a Clevelander. There was a story in Cleveland.com. There's a picture of me, you know, being walked out of the Cuyahoga County Courthouse in handcuffs. I've reformed my life. I'm a changed man. I think this should go away. What's the process?
If you send us a note, and we publicize this once a month and do our best to get the word out, you send us a note. If your mistake didn't involve violence or a sex crime or public corruption, we'll consider it. And the standard, and it's a tough one, I get all the editors together who are available and we talk it through, is the value of keeping that story online greater than the value to somebody's life of having it come down? Sometimes the answer is yes. If it's a police officer that's done something wrong and is still working as a police officer, the feeling is, you know, people ought to know that. We had a recent one with a teacher. He had retired but could still be working as a substitute that had done upskirt photographs a few years back. And we thought, you know, a parent ought to be able to find that out if this teacher is with their kids. So we said no to that. Almost universally, though, it's a yes, because there is almost no news value for these dated stories.
We're speaking to Chris Quinn, editor of Cleveland.com. Chris, is right to be forgotten a fair way to describe your policy? I mean, that term is loaded for a lot of people. How do you see it?
That's what we call it. We really did trade on the European Union. Now, look, I got to tell you right up front, there's no way we would ever support legislation to do this. The First Amendment would anything like that would violate the First Amendment. We feel it's more of a social justice issue now. That when society, you say you did that crime and you walk out and the picture's there and you've paid your penalty, society has established what you have to do to make it right. Who are we to make you continue paying? And that is the crux of what our decision's about.
Have you noticed any trends in who is applying for stories to be removed from certain demographics, certain parts of the region?
No, we're not getting what we haven't gotten is people who are young who were out there making a mistake and are now older. What we're getting is a lot of people who in their early 20s did something and now they have kids that might be exploring the internet, or it's people looking for jobs. What I'm most worried about is that we're reaching the people who are most often on our site. But that's not a universal representation of Cleveland. So we're trying to work with the courts as they do their expungement seminars to reach people who might be in poverty, who this could be very helpful with when they go to seal their records. And so I hope we increase the diversity of what we're seeing.
So there has been some outreach related to this.
Yeah, and we publicize it big every month. We didn't at first. I was a little bit worried that we were going to be deluged. And, you know, like most media, we're pretty resource challenged. So we could not have handled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of requests. We're doing 10 to 15 a month, which is about the max that we can handle.
You said that the standards, and I just want to make sure I heard them right, it can't be a story or matter that involves like a sex crime or a violent crime. Is that it?
Well, and public corruption. We've had a lot of issues in Northeast Ohio with public corruption. It seems like people forget those mistakes, and we're the guardians, we're the watchdog, and we just feel that if you've committed a crime against the public trust, that's going to stay out there. We have had some requests from people who were caught up in the corruption scandals here, and we've said no.
What about like a Bernie Madoff? He didn't commit a violent crime. He didn't commit a sex crime, and he's not an elected official. Do you think he has a right to be forgotten?
Let me give you the parallel. We had a financial service company that asked to have some things taken down. It was 10 years earlier, had been civilly sued by the government for doing bad things with their investors' money. Their argument was, it's 10 years later. We're well beyond that. We no longer operate that way. We've replaced all the people who were there then, and this is hurting us. And the feeling of the group was, you know, anybody that's going to put their life savings with this company deserves to know that this company had a history of abusing their clients' money. And so I think with Madoff, that would be the argument, is if there's any chance that he would be involved with people's money, people have a right to know. Madoff isn't a really good example, though, because with many of the cases we get, we're the only ones that covered it because we cover a lot of things. With Madoff, the whole world covered it. So us removing it doesn't make a difference. And that's why I think ultimately this whole process needs to rest on the Googles. That instead of having 1,000 media entities deciding this individually as they try to work this out, why not have Google or another search engine build a universal process that we could all subscribe to.
And we'll bring up Google in just a minute, but that's a good point. We'll talk about Google in just a second. One listener from Detroit texted us, "In high school, a group of my friends and I dressed as Native Americans for Halloween. We are all white women. The biggest impact is my deep shame for engaging in such cultural appropriation. Those Facebook photos are out there forever." I hear what you're saying, Chris, in terms of forgiveness, but there's also a certain moral opprobrium that comes along with being memorialized in the newspaper that sends a signal that, like, this is not okay, and if you do it, there are consequences that you can't shake off. Isn't that also an important function of a free press?
I get back to clearly that writer made a mistake, right, and they regret it. How long do they have to pay for that? Is it 30 years? Is it 20 years?
Not nearly as long as it's been okay for white people to make fun of Native Americans.
No, I want to reiterate, I'm not arguing we have the answer here. What we're trying to do is find our way. And these are difficult questions. I think if we heard from somebody in that situation, we would take it down. The one thing you mentioned, forgiveness, we're really specific on saying we don't feel we're in a position to forgive anything. I mean, that puts an authority on us that I just don't claim. What we're trying to do is get back to a point in America where if you did something that was covered in the news, that it would fade. Mm-hmm. Right now, it doesn't fade. It stays there forever.
I do hear you in terms of this being a larger issue for search engines, and I want to get to that as we continue our conversation with Chris Quinn, the editor of Cleveland.com. We'll get to some more of your questions and comments as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the right to be forgotten online with Chris Quinn, who's the editor of Cleveland.com. We'd love to hear from you, too. Is there anything online about you that you wish you could erase? Maybe one of your old mistakes has haunted you online, or not even necessarily a mistake, just something about you that might be unflattering or unsavory or controversial. Have you ever tried to either remove something online or perhaps bury it in the search results? What did you do and how did that go? We'd also just love to know your thoughts on this. This is a really interesting First Amendment question, right at the bleeding edge of the way the world views free speech. So we'd love to know your questions and thoughts about this. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before we bring in another guest and continue our conversation, Chris, I wonder if you are seeing other newsrooms talk about this. I understand other newsrooms have reached out to you, including the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the Tampa Bay Times, which is the largest paper in Florida. How do you see this possibly catching on or at least sparking a conversation more broadly?
It's catching on in a big way. I mean, I'm having a conversation with Atlanta, I think, this afternoon. I've heard from Baltimore. I haven't talked directly to the Tampa Bay Times, but I know they're doing it because I talked to somebody at Pointer. Every newsroom is struggling with this. Anybody with a conscience has to struggle with this because the notes you get from people, they're in pain, man. And you just don't, it's a hard thing to look that in the eye and say, yeah, well, but that's the way we've always done it, so we have to stand by it. And so you're seeing more and more try to do it. The biggest fear they all have is the cost, that none of us have the resources to do this en masse. I mean, maybe there's a day where you charge a small fee and you have a full-time position, but I'm hoping that we get to a more global solution than that.
We should also note, since you mentioned the Tampa Bay Times and Pointer, the Tampa Bay Times is owned by a group called the Pointer Institute, which is a professional school for journalists. It's a nonprofit that owns the Tampa Bay Times in trust. So it makes sense that a school for journalists that deals very heavily with ethical issues would be interested in talking about the right to be forgotten. So too are many people in Europe, especially since laws have begun to change with regards to the right to be forgotten. And joining us from the BBC in London to discuss that is Adam Satriano, the Europe technology correspondent for the New York Times. Adam, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you define right to be forgotten as it is used as a legal term in the EU? Is it kind of the same as we've been discussing it so far, or is there a little difference to it?
It's very similar to what you've described. I mean, the big difference, of course, is that it's legally mandated, which makes it extremely different. So, I mean, the starting point in Europe is to realize that the views on privacy and speech are quite different than the United States, and a lot of this is shaped by World War II, when you had, of course, a collection of personal information by fascist and communist regimes. And, you know, speech has come to be realized to be seen as something that could have very dangerous effects. And so you have data protection laws now as that are date back to the 1990s, which essentially allowed individuals to go to a company or organization to ask for data to be deleted. And so this was more with respect to stuff that was held in a database, not a news article or public information that you would necessarily find on Google. But it became popularized in 2014 when the top court here surprisingly ruled that that these rules had to apply to Google, so that you as an individual could demand that Google delist from its search results certain things related to your name. And so it's broadly defined as stuff that is inadequate, irrelevant, or no longer relevant, or excessive. And there's supposed to be a balance there with the rights to information and what should be available in the public interest. And so there's this inherent tension within that.
Tell us how that would work in Europe, Adam. Suppose I wanted to get something removed. Who do I appeal to, and how does that work?
So if you wanted something removed from Google, you have to go directly to Google. So it used to be, before this court case and that was resolved in 2014, Google would say, this isn't our responsibility. You have to go to the source of this information and knock this out with them. We're just an intermediary. We have nothing to do with it. This said that Google is at the center of it, and that therefore they have to. So you would apply to Google, as many people have since then. And they have their own internal review process in which they weigh whether or not it meets these standards that were laid out, or if it's within the public interest to keep it up. And so they have received requests to remove more than 3.3 million URLs or links since 2014. And they accept about 45% of those.
And we should note, by the way, Google, as I understand it, won a court case last month that said that this applies in Europe. It does not apply around the world, just in Europe, right?
That's correct. The way that this ruling was initially handed down, there was a certain amount of criticism about it that was left a lot open to interpretation. And so they had to return to it essentially to try and figure out what is the territorial reach of this. And in France, they were trying to get Google to apply this globally. So if you were a French citizen who wanted something removed, that it would have to be deleted not just within the European Union, but globally. In Google, as well as press or media organizations and free speech advocates, raised a lot of concerns about that in the court, ultimately, with some exceptions, ruled that it had to stay within the European Union.
This feels like it could get really sticky, Adam. I mean, I don't know how the laws apply to politicians and such, but you know, it would seem that under certain interpretations, depending on how the law is written, you could have someone like, you know, who may be part of a far-right extremist party that is kind of under the radar, who had some things in their past that weren't relevant to them at the time, but then they decide to seek public office, and now it's hard to link to information to them on Google. Has there been any talk about unintended consequences from this?
There has been a lot of talk on unintended consequences, and there's a lot of concern that there is a bit of a mission creep around right to be forgotten. You know, just before we were coming on the air, I was looking at some of the different cases that Google itself highlights, and it kind of gets at some of the tension here. In Bulgaria, there was a request to delist two news articles from search results about a person who faced accusations of abusing his child. Google ended up delisting that after the person proved that they had been acquitted. In France, Google deleted four links about the sentencing of an individual for sexual offenses against a child and a female adult. Google delisted them because the person had served their time. And so there's a lot of different cases like this that are similar to what Chris is dealing with that are very thorny and challenging.
Yeah, Chris Quinn, I wonder what your thought is on what we're seeing in the EU. I mean, it's there have even been, you know, news organizations, journalists who have ended up thousands of euros in debt because they fought it in court and lost. I mean, I just wonder how you view the international version of this, Chris.
Well, like I said, I don't think we could have it here. The First Amendment would protect us from being forced to do it. So I think it works more in the United States is what's the right thing to do. I would like to point out, though, because some of the stories we're talking about point out the idea that what we cover, we choose to cover. We're not global. We don't cover everything. There was a 4-year period in Cleveland where we had a reporter that basically did police blotter. If you happen to get arrested for a tiny minor crime in those 4 years, there's a story about you on our site. But if you did it just before, or just after, you're not. It's fairly arbitrary, which is also a troubling issue for us. Your question about the person that wants to clear their ugly past as they run for office, that's a troubling question, and we don't have a good answer for that. Some of the things we will take down ultimately, I think, would have proven useful down the road. What we're trying to do is balance what's the greater good.
And I just want to be clear, Chris, when you take down a story, you're just taking it down from the website, right? It still exists in an archive somewhere, or are you erasing it as though the story had never been reported?
95% of the time, what we're doing is taking out the identifying information, leaving the story up. There are a few cases where that's pretty much impossible without turning the story into gibberish where we take it down. And I think in one case, we were having so much trouble with our technology that we ended up just deleting the story.
I know we got to let you go in just a minute, Chris, but let me read a few comments from our listeners. One listener tweeted, "One person with my name was charged with bank fraud. Another person with my name in a different state was charged for sleeping with a minor. Now I add my middle initial as part of my social media." And Chris, I wonder if you could answer this question from Robert, who tweeted, "We're hearing a lot about the accused or convicted, but what about the victim? In either of these cases, do they contact or allow for the victim to provide a say?" Chris?
We have not, and because the victim's recourse is through the official court system. We're not the public's accountability. If you're a victim of a crime, there's a system by which you get to address the criminal. It's the courts. We're reporting the stories we choose to report. So we haven't done that. It's a question that's come up, though. I don't argue that I have a good answer for it.
Chris Quinn is the editor of Cleveland.com. Chris, this is a fascinating First Amendment experiment, and there is no easy answers, but it's good to hear you kind of think out loud about them, and we appreciate you making time for us. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Glad to get some of your stories about how the impact of long-lasting news articles have affected you. Rick tweeted, "I was 16 and accused of a crime. My age was reported wrong, saying I was 18. The local news ran an article online, and despite my acquittal, the report still pops up, and I have to answer questions about it. While I don't know for sure, I do believe it cost me 2 jobs. Alex in New Hampshire emailed, "My neighbor has a history of stalking and violently attacking anyone that's lived in our home over the past 20 years. Our local newspaper has articles about her available online, and we provided them to the court. I think these should be left up for whomever buys our house in the future." Glad to get some of your comments and thoughts on this. Please do keep them coming, 1a@wamu.org. Let's add another voice to our conversation. Here with me in studio is Emma Alonso, the director of the Free Expression Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Emma, welcome to 1A.
It's great to be here.
What's your take on the right to be forgotten?
Oh, boy. It's a big issue that obviously has a lot of resonance here in the U.S. as well as is part of the law in Europe. I think the examples that Chris Quinn from Cleveland.com was giving about the kinds of questions that that newspaper is going through when they think about should they give people some kind of right to be forgotten really shows that this is not a huge difference between the U.S. and European sort of mindset. People care about their reputations, but we also care about things like freedom of the press and accurate historical records. One of my biggest concerns about the right to be forgotten, and especially as we're seeing it play out in Europe, is who we are having make the decisions about what gets forgotten. The European framework puts that right now on the backs of search engines. And Google has an enormous market share in Europe. Most of the cases and the discussions have been about Google. I think we were talking a little bit earlier. They've had some 850,000 requests in the 5 years since the right to be forgotten has really been in force in Europe, and had to make decisions about 3.4 million URLs. They decide in about 45% of those cases to delist the information. That's a lot of decision making that they're doing, and it happens in a way that's not necessarily kind of transparent or accountable to the general public. You know, Google, very much to their credit, puts out a transparency report, and they try to provide as much information as they can, but they're bound by data privacy laws. There's only so much they can reveal about the cases that they're handling.
It does seem, Emma, like there are a number of principles, both legally and just ideologically, philosophically, between the U.S. and the EU that would make something like right to be forgotten tricky, at least, if it was implemented here. But I do understand the argument from some folks saying, you know, in the good old days, unless somebody combed through the archives to try to find something on you, they wouldn't find it. Rebecca emailed, when newspapers were printed, no one could simply click on these old stories. A reader had to go to a library and scroll microfilm. We're in a very different age now, Emma, and it does seem like, you know, every little screw up is just, you can find it on the phone in your pocket.
Right. And that's where I think seeing experiments like Cleveland.com is doing, or what the website archive.org does with some kinds of sensitive material that it is archiving, because that's its whole role, but putting some barriers to access, kind of understanding that there can be a difference between making information enormously readily publicly available with the simplest of searches online and putting a couple of bumps in the road so that it's not immediately the thing that shows up at the top of every list of search results. I think what we're really sort of working through here, both in the US and Europe, is what the seamless connectivity of the internet means for our information environment. And entities like newspapers, like archives, like public records databases that state governments run have to think about just how publicly available are they making this information. There's a huge benefit to making it more readily accessible than having to go down to the courthouse or having to scroll through microfiche. But there are also downsides.
Glad to get some of your voicemails about the stories of what you've had to deal with in terms of your online information. Here's what Kelly left in our inbox.
My name is Kelly. I was arrested a couple of years ago, falsely arrested. I took it to court, won, case totally dismissed. But my record, you know, of being arrested, and my picture is online from the mugshot, and now I'm having to spend over $1,000 in over about a year to get it expunged. I don't think you should have to pay that kind of money if a case was dismissed on a false arrest.
Kelly, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Adam, before we pause, what about the economics of having links broken online? Does cost create an issue, maybe for people who are lower income?
Yeah, in the United States, there's these sites in which he's talking about, these mugshot sites, which essentially they will post mugshots and then you as an individual can pay to have them removed. I mean, they're criticized for being extortion sites, which is sort of, I think, a fair descriptor.
And also just for being fairly sleazy. Like, let's go to court and grab all the mugshots we can and then, you know, embarrass people and make them pay not to be embarrassed.
Yeah, it's just sort of swarmy. So there's instances like that in there, but the broader question here is comes down to what the legal rationale is and who's ultimately responsible. And in the United States, by and large, and as well in Europe in many instances, the platforms are not held responsible in the same way. So the websites that carry these images or in the instances of revenge porn as well. Mm-hmm. The platforms are not as held responsible.
We'll continue in a moment with Adam Satriano of the New York Times and Milanso at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And in a moment, we'll hear from a playwright who is discussing the right to be forgotten in her latest work. She joins us and we'll take more of your questions in a minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Adam Satriano of the New York Times and Emma Lanso of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Alex tweeted, "I am worried about an insurance company hiring a third-party information broker to look up my young son and be able to raise premiums or deny coverage in the future. I shared an innocuous post on Facebook about a surgery he had as an infant. My mistake." Adam Satriano, that is really, really chilling. Are there any considerations in Europe right now about how companies might use information online in ways that could be deleterious or damaging?
Yes, definitely. In last year, Europe adopted this new data privacy law, the GDPR, it's known as, and it gives people new rights to essentially order companies to delete certain personal information about them, or to you can request to have to see what information a company holds about you. So in this instance, this individual could petition their insurance company to be able to see what kind of information perhaps was collected about them. California has done something not quite as far-reaching, but has also done sort of data privacy, things like that. But in terms of getting things removed from Facebook like that, it gets a bit more thorny, and whether or not you can delete it, of course, yourself, but how it's proliferated and who has a copies of it, these things can very much live on.
Emma, could we talk a little more about the First Amendment argument with the right to be forgotten? I can kind of see two sides of it. I understand in terms of the free press aspect how the right to be forgotten could be problematic. Granted, free speech rights are not absolute. Libel is not protected. Slander is not protected. Hate speech that's intended to cause imminent violence is not protected. But on the other hand, the absence of speech is also free expression. So if I want to have something removed, I could see someone making a case in court under the First Amendment saying that my effort to change my public perception is a form of free expression that also should be protected. How do you see it?
That's interesting. Yeah. So the First Amendment is going to provide a lot of protection for a lot of the information that people think about when they think about the right to be forgotten, because we're typically talking about information that is not defamation or libel or slander. It's true. It's been lawfully made public, but it's old or it's out of date or it's what people think of as no longer relevant or no longer the perspective or the face that they want to put to the world. And that's very understandable that people want to have that ability to control their reputation. But when we're talking about could there be a law to restrict the spread of true, lawfully published information, the answer under the First Amendment is going to be no. The option that people have for changing and developing their reputation is counterspeech, right? It's putting out what is the view of me that I want people to see. It's trying to get that top search result to be something that you've published about yourself or a different story about, you know, your successes or achievements since, something negative happened in your past. That's really the kind of remedy that we have under the First Amendment. It's suppressing the bad speech with more speech.
Yeah, in terms of search results, that's what Elmer emailed about. Elmer writes, "I am a retired college Title IX coordinator. Several years ago, a student was accused of sexual assault. The complaint went to the police after reporting to the college. The respondent's picture ended up on the front page of the local newspaper. The complainant's story was later completely debunked, and the respondent was vindicated. However, if you Google his name, that newspaper picture and story comes up." We also got this voicemail from a listener who's got a very personal but not uncommon situation in terms of online information. Here's what Tyreen had to say.
Hey, my name is Tyrene. The thing is, I'm in transition. I'm going female to male. Occasionally, pictures of me as a struggling female appear that I don't expect. I didn't even know were taken. I tried my whole life to not be photographed. So that's what I'd like erased.
Tyrene, thank you for sharing your story. And Adam, I'd like you to respond to this one. What Tyrene is getting at has to do with something that particularly affects gender non-binary and transgender people, even down to what's known as dead naming, where the name that they were given before their transition is the name that constantly pops up. Facebook has gotten smacked for this from the LGBTQ rights community for requiring trans people to use the name on their birth certificate or driver license, even if they're transitioning. So it kind of forces them to be dead named, which is vile. Has Europe contemplated anything like this? Like, there are some really good, legitimate reasons why a person should have 300% control over their identity and how they're viewed online.
I don't know about examples of these specific cases, but there are ways in which Europe is classifies their upper protections for certain classifications of data and sexual orientation and gender and things like that are also among those that have to do that, as well as political affiliation, religion, and things like that. And so those give individuals an added bow to play with, or arrow to sort of push back against some of these things when they see that they want to have something changed.
Emma?
Well, and I think one thing to underscore that's really important in thinking about this in the U.S. is that the First Amendment constrains what the law can require. A social media company has a lot of freedom in deciding what policies it has and how it enforces those. And that's, I think, another really important question. Who are we asking to make what kinds of decisions here? If the law requires a search engine to apply a kind of generic set of standards to suppress information from the public record, that raises huge concerns. If a company who you have a first-person relationship with, you've created an account there and you've decided you want to change the name of that account, that company can let you do it. And if they're not letting you do it, that's what, you know, that's where I think we need to ask questions. What is the, you know, control that that company has over the information you've directly provided to them?
Interesting to hear some of your comments, that kind of the way that you've been thinking out loud about this idea. Greg tweeted, "A major flaw in Right to be Forgotten is archives. Any embarrassing news story will be posted on Internet Archives. Links to the story elsewhere will remain up, making it easy to find." Jason emailed, "Isn't it time we have the conversation about how the founding fathers never could have imagined the technology that we have and the harm that the news could do to individuals?" Interesting that we're talking about this in a larger sense, because Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who's running for the Democratic nomination, surprised some people when he said he supported the right to be forgotten. Here is Mayor Buttigieg speaking to Kara Swisher on the podcast Recode Decode.
I think we need a national data framework. I think the right to be forgotten, for example, needs to be encoded. Look, every time a company the size of YouTube or Amazon or Google or Facebook makes a corporate policy decision, what they're really doing is making a public policy decision.
Yeah.
But they have none of the apparatus to make public policy. And I don't think they want to.
That's Democratic presidential candidate Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, speaking to Kara Swisher on Recode Decode. Emma, what about that? Is there any movement toward passing some kind of legislation, right to be forgotten-esque laws here in the U.S.?
Well, there's definitely a big push to finally get a federal baseline privacy legislation in the United States. We don't have a comprehensive privacy framework the way that the Europeans do with the General Data Protection Regulation. We have a lot of different sectoral privacy protections. There's things like the Fair Credit Reporting Act. There's health privacy protection laws, protection for children's privacy online, and a variety of state laws, including a big one in California that will, I think, be going into effect coming up in 2020. But we don't have one comprehensive federal privacy law, though we are finally starting to see a lot of attention on that in Congress. My organization, Center for Democracy and Technology, actually has a draft model bill that we'd like to see Congress consider that would do things like give people the right to access and correct and even delete information that companies directly hold about them, and would also draw some lines around fundamentally unfair data practices.
We should also note before we move on from this, one member of the 1A Text Club wrote, "I had an ex put pictures of me on a revenge website. He took it down, but you always wonder if it is still out there somewhere. The internet is forever. Guess I will never run for office." Adam, it's worth noting that there are certain types of content that Google and American courts and European courts have been willing to address, namely things like what Emma is describing, what are often commonly referred to as revenge porn or non-consensual pornography.
Yeah, they have. And some of this goes to, again, what I was referring to earlier is who's held responsible. And as Emma was saying, the companies themselves can act in their own to take down this material. But there are websites that essentially host this kind of content. But the state laws that have been passed, and Emma, please jump in if I don't get this right, but the state laws that have been passed don't hold the websites themselves necessarily responsible. It's much more about charging the individuals who's responsible for essentially or taking the video or sharing the video or posting it on the website. Those are the ones that the laws primarily go after.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. You know, for people with information about themselves online that they would rather have forgotten, a lot of things in life can be a big challenge. Jenny emailed about her 25-year-old son who's in recovery. Jenny writes, "Anytime he applies for a job, if his prospective employer Googles his name, the mugshot for heroin possession is the first thing to be found. A decent job is a very important part of addiction recovery, but this photo makes it very difficult. Hiring is one area where having past information can be a real challenge. So too is dating."
You're funny.
Really? No one's ever said that to me before.
I have a screwy sense of humor. I get it from my dad.
So I know this is just a drink or whatever, but I just have to tell you, my name isn't really Arthur.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to give you my real name because if I gave you my real name, then you'd Google me.
So are you going to tell me your real name?
That was a scene from the play Right to be Forgotten. It premiered here in Washington at Arena Stage, and joining us now in studio is its playwright, Sharon Rothstein. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your play about?
My play is the story of a young man, Daryl Lark, who's 27. He's about to graduate from a PhD program, and he wants to teach. He wants to settle down.
Is this not Arthur?
He is Arthur,
right.
But he's not really Arthur.
Right.
And he did something bad when he was in high school. It's been on the internet ever since, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own. Some of it's true, some of it's not. And he decides he's going to try to take on the tech companies and win the right to be forgotten.
What made you decide to write this play?
I had started following the news coming out of the European Union about 5 years ago, and I thought it was so interesting, just the verbiage around it, the right to be forgotten, that we would want that. And as I thought more about it and started exploring more, what I realized is that the technology we've created is very much at odds with how humanity has always existed. We've always forgotten things. It's always been more rare to remember. And so the play really came from this desire to explore what happens when who we are as humans hits up against our technology and the restrictions that we've embedded in our new systems.
Are there certain aspects of that that you began to think about differently or think about for the first time as a result of putting this play together? I don't want to give away the story by giving away your revelation, but are there any things that you had to kind of puzzle over?
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is I still don't know how I feel about the right to be forgotten and whether we should have it in this country or whether we shouldn't. And my hope is that people who come to this play leave in conversation about it. But I'm assuming people are going to come in with different perspectives and leave with different perspectives. I think it's really interesting that we hold so tightly to our First Amendment rights, and I think we should hold so tightly to those rights in this country. But at the same time, I think it's a really good question as to who gets to determine what counts as free speech online, whether that should be the companies or the government or the people themselves.
What kinds of reactions has the play been getting?
You know, people have been really intrigued. It's been really wonderful to see how eager people are to really engage with these characters and what they've been through. I hear after every performance, I hear people turning to each other and saying, "We need that. We should have that right to be forgotten." And I hear people saying, "That's we can never have that. We need, you know, the First Amendment is paramount." So I think there's the political reaction has been really interesting, but also I get the play is funny and it has a lot of heart, and so there's a lot of emotional reaction too.
Since we are here in Washington and Arena Stage is like a mile and a half from the Capitol, do you hope that the play influences public policy or that a few congressional aides will sit down and then talk to their bosses?
I mean, that would be amazing. I think that hope is that we start having a broader conversation about the right to be forgotten. In general, when I talk to people about the play, most people who are out of the tech sector don't really know about the right to be forgotten. And I think that since moving forward, all of our lives are going to live online. And the whole generation that came after me has their entire childhood documented. I think it's time that we have a real conversation, both in the halls of Congress and with each other, about what we want to live forever online.
And briefly, any plans to tour the play, or is it just at Arena Stage for now?
The play will be at the Victory Gardens Theater in Chicago in the spring.
For now, it's playing at Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. It's called Right to be Forgotten, written by playwright Sharon Rothstein. It runs at Arena Stage through November 10th. Sharon, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Also, Emma Alonso, the director of the Free Expression Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Emma, thank you.
Thank you.
And Adam Cetriano, the Europe Technology Correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. See you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.